At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. This week, I'm joined by Craig Lee. Craig joins me to talk about his experience of having an eating disorder, body dysmorphia, and suicidal ideation for International Men's Day. It was a real privilege to be able to speak to Craig and speak so openly with him about his experience. I really hope that anybody listening finds comfort in this and know that you're not alone.
Thank you so much for joining, like coming on today. I really want to chat to you. I was like, we're gonna find a date. We are absolutely gonna find a date.
We did. We made it. Took some doing, but we got there.
We did. Yes. And this is gonna sound really weird, but I just need to say it. When I first watched your video on Instagram, I was like, I really wanted to chat to you because I'm in love with your accent. Are you from?
I'm from County Durham, and I wish TikTok shared your love for my accent, because when I'm doing the captions, it really just doesn't have a clue. I'm having to go through and edit everything.
Oh god. Oh my, wow. Yeah. Oh
thank
dear,
you.
That's so annoying.
Yeah. I've gotten the hang of it now, I've accepted it.
Yeah, that must take forever though to go through everything.
Thankfully, it doesn't take too long. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Well, I just wanted to tell you that I was a big fan of your accent.
Thank you.
So we'll get started. It's this month, I think, but it's today, isn't it? That it's International Men's Day.
Yeah.
International Men's Day? Yeah. So I'm actually going to edit this afterwards and then put it out this evening so that we get it on the day. But I think this year, in particular for International Men's Day, they're talking about, suicide and zero suicide rate or something that they've named it or something. Yeah. And so I'd really love today to talk to you about your own personal experience of an eating disorder and body dysmorphia and how kind of suicidal ideation plays into that. So to get us started, do you want to kind of just give the listeners a bit of an intro about yourself and then we can start talking about your experience?
Absolutely. Thank you. So I'm Craig. I'm a qualified counsellor and psychotherapist specialising in eating disorders. And it's only very recently that I've chosen to specialise in eating disorders after my own recovery. But I've been working in health behaviour change services and mental health services, mainly charities with the latter, for about 18 years. Qualified as a counsellor in 2012, and then have just launched my private practice this year.
Exciting. Yeah. Very exciting. And so you said there that you have recently just been doing the eating disorder thing, and you said that was because of your own experience. So do you want to tell us a bit more about what your experience was of I always hate asking that because it's like, oh, you know, give me it in a few sentences. And it's like, that was my life and it was horrific. But yeah.
Yeah. It will be difficult to sum up in a few sentences just because it was so complex. And like many people with an eating disorder, it changed over time. So I had an eating disorder the majority of my adult life, developed probably when I was around 19, 20, and I've been in recovery now for the past year. And we can certainly go in and look at, you know, some of the things that may have led to me developing the eating disorder and the what we'd call predisposing factors, because there were plenty. But, you know, if we were to put categories and labels, certainly bulimia, orthorexia, atypical anorexia has been the sort of pattern through my life. Yeah.
And when you were just saying there about kind of like the predisposing factors, what kind of was it for you that you felt led to the development of your eating disorder?
Yeah, I mean, we know this with eating disorders that it's multifactorial, you know, that there's not a single cause that you can identify, but there are certain predisposing factors that can very much account for people developing eating disorder. And so with myself, I can see a number of things. It was there were several childhood traumas, bullying, body image issues, which led to development of body dysmorphia in my teens. And particularly with men, you know, the entry point for eating disorders seems to be getting involved in trying to be fitter and exercise. Mm-hmm. And there was very much that, you know, in my teens, I started going to the gym and lifting weights and trying to get bigger and more muscular. Mm. And that was certainly the beginning of the path. And then it's really difficult. It's a chicken and egg situation sometimes, you see, with this, because I developed depression, you know, in my late teens. But was the depression a result of, you know, the sort of body dysmorphia, as it certainly can be? Or did the, you know, did the depression come from poor nutrition? Or was it, you know, the sort of low mood that made me more likely to develop poor eating behaviours? You can't always define an exact cause with these things. And the good news is you don't have to. And one of the reasons I really wanted to do this podcast was to talk a bit about my experience and how complex it was, so that people can see it's not necessarily a straightforward, for example, this trauma happened, developed an eating disorder, got this diagnosis, and this was how recovery went, and there we are. It's very rarely that simple.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I always feel so bad saying to people, like, oh, can you just kind of, you know, give me a bit of information about your experience? Because one thing I find is, you know, once somebody's been in recovery, they seem to have this kind of, they can talk about it and they can explain, you know, because they've done so much processing of it. They can be like, this thing happened and then I developed an eating disorder and then I went through recovery and now I'm here. And it seems so linear. But then when you're in the midst of an eating disorder, it feels like an absolute minefield and you just can't even grasp what's going on. So for somebody then to be like, oh, yeah, like it happened, then this happened, then this happened, I personally would always think like, oh, well, I'm never going to recover because I haven't got my story figured out like that. So definitely to think about like the fact that, you know, and also I really liked what you said about, you can think about the factors that maybe predisposed you, but one, you're never going to know anyway, because it could have been the absolute smallest thing in the world. And that was the thing that kind of hit it off. And two, it doesn't really matter. I think that a lot of people now are talking about in treatment, you know, rather than going back to your past and trying to heal your past in order to heal the eating disorder, it's about thinking about what you can do in the present so that you can move forward regardless of, you know, what's happened to you in the past, you can move forward and have coping mechanisms in place that mean you don't need the eating disorder.
No, I'd certainly agree with that. Although there is very much a place, especially at the beginning of eating disorder therapy. My training was through the National Centre for Eating Disorders, and mm-hmm. our approach at the beginning of therapy is to do what's called a lifeline. So to actually go through a person's life from childhood up to the present and help to identify what some of those predisposing factors might have been. And I do think that's important because, again, going back to my experience, it helped me have a lot more compassion for myself. And, you know, this certainly doesn't just happen with men, but I think there is a particular stigma with men around sort of gender roles and masculinity. So, you know, for most of my life, I had that experience of feeling that because I had an eating disorder, it meant I was weak. Any other kind of negative terms you want to add to that have probably been through my head. But having that understanding and being able to see all of this on the lifeline, I remember saying to my therapist, of course I developed an eating disorder. It made complete sense. And I think until you can have that understanding, it can be difficult to move forward because I needed to know that I deserved to recover and that this wasn't just a personality flaw. It wasn't just me being weak.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I don't think, you know, as a therapist, I don't think the answer comes from just focusing exclusively on the past. It has its place, but actually, and you'll see this in a lot of my videos, I talk about, you know, meaning and purpose, because recovery is so much more about it's so much more than symptom alleviation. You know, it's you've got to focus on what's in your life now and what is going to be your meaning for recovery and achieving the things you haven't been able to achieve, because eating disorders, you know, steal your joy. They prevent you from living life fully, quite frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? A lot of the time people are focused on kind of the symptoms or the behaviours, and that's obviously a part of it, and then they play into how you live your life, but ultimately the eating disorder takes your life from you. And I think that's recovery, isn't it? Is getting that back.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of... there were so many things that you just said, I've had to write them down to make sure that I don't forget anything. But you mentioned about you know, when you were younger, you got into the gym, and that's quite common in people in men that have eating disorders. And to be honest with you, it's a bit of a kind of gripe of mine in that, you know, we've had the experience of anorexia is like a female eating disorder. And now we're really pushing for this rhetoric of like, if a man has an eating disorder, it's muscle dysmorphia. And I'm really glad that, you know, there's more research coming out about muscle dysmorphia and it's getting the airtime. But I'm just like, you know, not every man that has an eating disorder is going to be muscle dysmorphia. You know, all presentations of eating disorders can show up. And I think, yeah, I think before, if we're not careful, it is going to go from, you know, I think we had this rhetoric of gay men get anorexia before. I think that possibly still exists. And then men get muscle dysmorphia, but we're not really thinking about the other eating disorders, or, you know, just the fact that men can get an eating disorder in just the same way as a woman can. It's not kind of, you know, based on anything else.
Absolutely. And it's, I think you're right, it we've got to be careful in that focus on, okay, yes, we know a lot of the messaging out there is focused on females, because predominantly it's females who tend to present with eating disorders. But if we are then just focusing on males who have muscle dysmorphia, which is a type of body dysmorphic disorder, which, you know, in itself is more of a obsessive compulsive disorder than anything, and doesn't always go hand in hand with an eating disorder. But if we then just narrow our focus down to those men, we're missing a wide range of men who will be suffering with binge eating in particular. That's one of the things that seems to present mostly when it comes to eating disorders in men. It is binge eating, though I suspect over the next few years we're going to see a lot more around the orthorexic side with, you can't go on social media these days without someone telling you they're doing intermittent fasting or keto or whatever it is. And, you know, even with myself, beyond the gym, I had an injury when I was 19 or 20, and I ended up stopping lifting weights sort of in my late 20s because I developed a cervical spondylosis type of arthritis. And
okay. At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You know, I was quite a committed Buddhist in the Theravada tradition, where actually the ideal is sort of almost under-eating. And I certainly don't want to paint this out as a feature of Buddhism. I very much brought my eating disorder to Buddhism and used it as an excuse. But before I met my wife, I was planning on ordaining as a Buddhist monk and very much had that restrictive mentality around it. And so I used Buddhism as my excuse to restrict, and saw being as thin as possible as a goal, as something to be almost proud of. And there was certainly no one in the Buddhist community at all encouraging this or cheering it on. It was sort of that part of me that knew what I was doing but wasn't ready to admit it. So you know, there's all these complexities there that don't fit into the, as you say, the narratives that we seem to be seeing around males with eating disorders.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point. And I think it's quite common in that, whether, you know, it's a religious practice or, you know, maybe it's being vegetarian or something like that, when it's like an accepted thing of, you know, as a Buddhist monk, you want to kind of, you know, stay thin and things like that. That's such an easy way for an eating disorder to kind of latch onto that and be like, well, you know, it's fine because it's what everybody else is doing. But it's not the actual practice that is the issue. It's the way that your brain works and how that aligned with the practice. And then it's kind of like using the practice in order to let the eating disorder thrive, which I guess is so difficult to then kind of navigate as to, you know, this is the practice that I am engaging in and I want to, but equally, like, it's having a negative impact on my eating disorder. So where on earth do I go here?
Yeah. And there is that tunnel vision you get with an eating disorder, where I was conveniently ignoring the fact that, you know, the practices I was engaging in, there were rules and allowances within Buddhism that meant I didn't have to follow those practices if it was causing me any harm. But, you know, that aesthetic mindset that often comes with eating disorders wanted the restriction.
Yeah. And I think that's when you know that you're not engaging with things properly, is, you know, when it's sacrificing your health, and then you're being told, you know, you don't have to do this if it's having a negative impact on you and you're still doing it. It's like, well, maybe there's some other things we need to look into here.
Definitely. And, you know, at the time, I didn't even think I had an eating disorder. You know, as far as I was concerned, I'd recovered from bulimia in my 20s, and I was trying to follow this restrictive diet, which I kept failing and binging, which is often the case with any kind of restriction. But for me, it wasn't that I was doing something wrong in trying to achieve that. There was a sense of, well, you know, of course I'm going to look after my health. Everybody else is wrong for eating junk and you know, eating too much. I thought I was just being weak and failing to follow what was a sensible and logical thing to do for health improvement and longevity. And that's the big thing there. An eating disorder deceives and it blinds you completely to the reality of things.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think blinds you to the reality of the behaviours, the impact it's having on you, it's the impact it's having on everybody around you. I think, like, you used a really good phrase there, that tunnel vision. I think when you have an eating disorder, that's exactly what happens. And I want to come back to something in a second that you just said, but just going back to something you said before, was you were saying about how women with eating disorders present more frequently than men with eating disorders, but actually we're learning that men, you know, have it's quite common for binge eating and things like that. And I just wanted to ask your thoughts around, because I know with autism, we're now realizing that actually it's not that autism is more common in boys, it's that autism presents itself in a very different way in girls and women, and therefore the sort of support that people need is completely different. Do you think that's potentially what's happening with eating disorders, is that actually they're probably just as common in men, but maybe the way that they're presenting isn't the way that we're used to, so we don't spot it as often?
I certainly think there are elements of that with I'm going to have to use the sort of gym and exercise example here, but, you know, if you take, for example, someone who is trying to bulk up and put on a lot of muscle, you know, they can be consuming vast amounts of calories in what for people who aren't trying to do that would be considered a binge, but it can be a socially acceptable binge because it's bulking. Yes. And then you've got the over-exercise element, which, you know, is very much a form of purging if you are over-exercising. Mm-hmm. But if it's someone who's outwardly just committed to their health, you know, going to the gym is a lifestyle choice and it's a hobby. And it's hard for people.
It's admirable.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so these things that can look like normal, admirable behaviours, you can't see what the underlying motivations are there, or what's going on behind closed doors that person is not willing to admit to themselves. Because I can certainly look back at my own behaviours, even, you know, beyond the gym days, where I was deceiving myself over what I was doing. So I do think there is that element about it maybe presenting a bit differently. But I do think the biggest factor, and a lot of the research supports this, is, you know, men less willing to come forward and talk about struggles. Mm. And we know that's the case with mental health in general. But with eating disorders, I think there's an added stigma there on top of an already existing stigma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was actually the other thing that I wanted to come on to, was because I completely agree. I think that the fundamental issue that we have is we haven't created a space where men feel that they can come forward and they can talk about difficulties that they're having with their body or with food and things like that. And one of my friends, she's an assistant psychologist, and she put something on her Instagram the other day that really got me thinking of, like, the way that we are trying to get men to talk about their mental health is the way that we do it with women. And women, we know, are naturally, you know, more open and more likely to share struggles that they're having. You know, you just have to think about, if I use my life for an example, when I go out and go with my friends, you know, we'll catch up, we'll talk about what's been going on in our lives, we'll, you know, discuss anything that we want some advice on, difficulties that we're having. You know, we might talk a little bit about, like, pop culture or whatever, but predominantly the conversation tends to be focused around, like, what's going on in our own lives. Whereas my partner, when he goes out with his friends, it's very much like surface level chat. It's, you know, what's going on in sport or what's going on in politics and things like that. And he will often come back from being with, so we basically, like, have two, there's a couple, and I'm best friends with the guy in the relationship, and he's best friends with the guy in the relationship, and we'll come back and I'll be like, oh yeah, like, they're doing this and they're doing that, and he won't have any idea because all they've spoken about is, like, things that are outside of their own lives, which I think is, you know, that's great to have a mix of those conversations. But that really just identifies to me that, like, women naturally talk about what's going on in their lives and talk to their friends about it, whereas men don't. So I think it's the approach that we need to, or the environment we need to create, needs to change drastically in order for men, because it's not just like they're talking about their mental health, it's they're talking about, you know, something personal to them, which isn't kind of the most natural thing, I don't think, for men to do.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's, there was some research that sort of looked at what the barriers are for men talking about mental health. Mm. And the predominant things that came back were men either feeling like, oh, I just need to deal with it, which is, you know, that mm-hmm. idea of being the breadwinner, being dominant, having control of everything, and at least being outwardly seen to be in control. But also what came up was the idea of not wanting to be a burden, not wanting to impose mm. yourself on another person. And I think we are moving steadily in the right direction with challenging these societal and cultural norms. And, you know, you've got more celebrities coming out and talking about mental health and even eating disorders, and that's great. I think we need more people with those kind of platforms to do that, and we're seeing things crop up like it's called Andy's Man Club, and, you know, things that are encouraging men to talk. But we also do have to acknowledge that, you know, that sort of I don't want to get that down the route of sort of looking at so-called toxic masculinity, because yes, there is certainly that element, but there are men that are just hyper-masculine who are maybe not toxic in any way, but that is culturally normal for them not to open up about their feelings. And I grew up on the east coast of County Durham, and talking about your feelings was not something you did as a man. And I was seen as probably less masculine because I'm quite naturally, unfortunately, an oversharer. And, you know, it's changing that culture is not something that's going to happen quickly, and it can't be forced. And so I think if we're wanting men to open up more, we can't force it. We have to, I'm going to use a Matrix reference here. We do have to show them the door, but they have to walk through it. We absolutely can't push them through it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's such a good point there. And I think, you know, as much as we are trying as a society to create a society where, you know, men and women are equal, and obviously, like, I'm very much for that, I think we can't ignore, like, the historical element of the role that men had and the role that women had. And I think, you know, you said it a couple of times in that I don't know whether you're referring to your eating disorder or mental health in general, but for you to have struggles with that meant that you were weak. And I think that a lot of men, even if they're, you know, even if they are, you know, see themselves as equal to women and stuff like that, I think it's often, and correct me if I'm wrong because I'm not a man, but a lot of the time it's sort of the comparison to other men, rather than it being like, oh, I don't want to be as weak as a woman by sharing my problems. It's almost like, well, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be weaker than my other male counterpart. And I think it's like you said there with the toxic masculinity, I think that's a really interesting kind of point, in that I completely agree, in that I don't think that, you know, just being masculine necessarily means that you're, you know, you have toxic masculinity. But I think that then it makes it even more difficult for somebody that, you know, maybe is more masculine to speak about their issues. I think it's amazing when they do. You know, I watched the Tyson Fury documentary recently and I thought it was absolutely amazing. Like, the world's like, is he like a heavyweight boxer? I should know that from, like, the world's undefeated heavyweight boxer is talking about his mental health, his depression, his bipolar, and then his dad's there, who's a proper, like, northern geezer, yeah, and he's on his jog for his daily mental health. And I'm like, that is absolutely amazing. Like, we need more people that are, you know, maybe the stereotypical man to share about their mental health and to show that it's totally okay and nobody thinks anything badly of you to share that. Because I think there's something to be said about putting yourself in a vulnerable position where you do share about your mental health. But the more that people do it, the more.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
People will realize, oh, like, you know, they're talking about that. So yeah, I think I can do that as well.
Yeah, yeah. I'd certainly like to see more boxers and MMA fighters and people like that talking about mental health and particularly eating disorders. Because I suspect it's a lot more prevalent than people realize within those kind of circles. But, you know, we need to see that variety of representation of men. And you do get that. I mean, you've seen, what's his name? I was going to say Norman Osborn, but that's the Green Goblin in Spider-Man because I'm a giant geek.
Richard Osman.
Yeah. Richard Osman, Christopher Eccleston, so Doctor Who. You know, we need to normalize that eating disorders don't discriminate. You know, it doesn't matter what gender, sexuality, hobbies, work you have. Anybody can develop an eating disorder, and the more we get that message out there, the more we normalize it, the more we can open up that door, which you're never going to force anybody through, but then you know the door's there in the first place.
Absolutely, yeah. And I really like what you said there as well in terms of, like, anyone can get an eating disorder, because I think often that the phrase men get eating disorders too is used. And for me, that, like, men get eating disorders too is, like, making it that it's different for a man to get an eating disorder, because it's like, oh, you know, men get them too, like, you know, we know it's a woman's problem, but, like, men get them too. Whereas when you just say anybody can get an eating disorder, it's not kind of like highlighting the fact that for a man to have an eating disorder is like a novel concept in our minds.
No, and that's a really good point, and I am absolutely guilty of using men get eating disorders too on my social media platforms, just because it is something that seems to get the message out there. Like, people engage with that a lot more than they engage with anybody can get an eating disorder, because it's so targeted. But you're absolutely right, that is in a way a part of, or at least a symptom of the problem. and that's why there is no...
It's hard, isn't it? It's... I was just going to say, it's really hard to strike that balance, because you don't just want to say anyone can get an eating disorder, because then it doesn't feel supportive to anyone, because you're just saying, well, anyone can get it. But at the same time, you know, that's sort of not the intention behind it. It's saying, you know, eating disorders don't discriminate. They can affect anybody. And you don't want to just kind of, you know, it'd be like saying, I don't know, older women can get eating disorders too. And it's like, oh, well, were we questioning whether older women could get an eating disorder? Like, does it look different for them? That sort of thing. So it's really difficult to strike that balance.
It is. And I think that's why there's not going to be a single solution or quick societal change around this, because it's multi-layered and it's complex. And things like this do take time. And I think you know, things are certainly shifting in the right direction. I remember when I first went to see my GP when I was 22, 23. I probably had an eating disorder a good 3 years at that point, but hadn't realised that's what it was. And I just remember the scepticism on his face when I was telling him. And it was, I can remember the look, you know, and it was this kind of, and the way he was asking the questions wasn't in any kind of normal information gathering way. It had that air of, are you sure you're doing this and doing this and doing this? And I'd like to think, I wouldn't just like to think, I've certainly seen over the past 15 years, the way eating disorders are talked about in men change. But we still got a long way to go. We really do.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting one. I think for people like us who work in the world of eating disorders, it's, you know, it's as obvious as anything that a man can have an eating disorder. But I still have conversations now, you know, whether it's with family members or people that are asking about the podcast and stuff like that. I say, can men get eating disorders? I'm like, why do you think that they can't? Like, let's think about that first. Like, you know, you're asking me that question. Why do you think that it is only a female issue instead of kind of, you know, men being able to have it as well? Because at the end of the day, we're every reason that you think of for an eating disorder, you know, like you said at the start, it's multifactorial. Like, none of them are gender specific. Like, everybody's subject to body ideals. Everybody's subject to diet culture. Everybody's subject, you know, potentially to trauma or to anything. Like, none of those things are based on your gender. So why would the development of an eating disorder?
Yeah. And then I think if you also look at what most people seem to think of an eating disorder, they think young, underweight females, when we know that actually most people with an eating disorder aren't underweight. So it's we're competing with this this kind of ingrained image of what an eating disorder looks like. So let alone focusing on men, we've still got a lot of work to do just to help people realize that even eating disorders in females doesn't mean being underweight, and that you can have anorexia without being underweight, for example.
Oh well, man, there's a whole host of work that we're slowly chipping away at. I wanted to ask you a bit more about your personal experience, because obviously this year for Men's Health Week, we are talking about suicide and opening up those conversations. And I wanted to understand a bit more about you, because you said about, you know, you had body dysmorphia and an eating disorder. And I wondered if that interplayed with the suicidal ideation. And I think for me, this is something really important to talk about, because I also have body dysmorphia, and I think when you say, oh, body dysmorphia, people are just like, oh, you struggle with your body image a bit. And yes, if you're going to put it in very little words. I struggle with my body image, but I don't think that often people realize the extent that it can go. And definitely for me, you know, I've thought, you know, I would be better off dead because my body is so horrific, or the kind of obsessions and the checking certain body parts became so tiresome and overwhelming that it just felt, you know, in my mind easier to not be here anymore than to have to engage in those behaviors. And I think because people often trivialize body image, body dysmorphia is very misunderstood. So I just wanted to kind of hear from you what your experience had been with body dysmorphia and the suicidal ideation.
Yeah, I mean, everything you've just said there definitely resonates, because I remember being 20, 21, sat at my desk at work thinking I'd rather be dead than continue to live with a body like this. And, you know, it was, every day was just a battle to not let those preoccupations overwhelm me. And there were a couple of times I did come close to making a suicide attempt. Thank you to my cat for stopping one of those attempts.
Wow. Can I ask how that happened? How your cat stopped you?
Yeah, I was just sitting at home on my couch thinking, right, that's it. I'm gonna go and do it. I had a plan. And she just comes trotting down the stairs, meowing at me for food. And I was like, absolutely not. I can't just leave her, you know. And it's that was the thing that did it. And I went and got help. And it did take many years after that before I overcame body dysmorphia. I actually overcame body dysmorphia as part of my eating disorder recovery. But that was the beginning of me really reaching out for help, because I knew I'd, you know, come too close that time. It wasn't the first time, but it was the closest I'd come. And, you know, it's, again, this is one of the narratives we need to change around suicidal ideation, because you still hear things such as, or that person was selfish to kill themselves, or selfish to even think about killing themselves and leaving their family, etc., etc. When you are in that mindset, it's not a rational mindset. You are absolutely convinced that that would be the best thing to do, that the pain you were in is so overwhelming that you believe that that would be the best for everyone. And it's not true. It absolutely is an irrational state of mind, but you can't judge someone for being so overwhelmed by those thoughts and feelings until you have felt them yourself. And I hope no one ever does who's listening to this, but it's not as simple as, oh, what's the phrase, taking the easy way out. And I hate that phrase because it absolutely really isn't.
Yeah.
So we need to change that narrative.
I think you've knocked the nail on the head there. I think when you're in that mindset, it feels like you're such a burden. I mean, this from my personal experience, you feel such a burden on everybody around you. And I think for me as well, like an eating disorder, you know, it finds its way into everything, whether that's your relationships, your family life, your work life, everything. And so because it causes such a nuisance for everybody around you, it's like, well, I can't let go of this eating disorder, and therefore the only way out is for the eating disorder and me to no longer be here. But like you said, that's never the case, and the people that, you know, love you dearly, you know, are always going to be there to support you. It's just that it can, you know, if we're being honest, it can be difficult to support someone with an eating disorder. But I think you're right in terms of the narrative needs to completely change, because I don't think, you know, coming to that decision, deciding to do that is ever a decision that somebody just kind of flippantly makes, and it's an easy decision to make. I think it's entwined with months and months of chronic depression and just not knowing, you know, you get so lost in it all that it doesn't feel like there's any other way out. But I think because of that rhetoric of it's, you know, a suicide attempt would be the easy way out, or, you know, it's sort of like the weaker option, I think that also ties into the whole aspect of men not speaking openly about their mental health or about struggling with suicidal ideation, because because they hear, you know, oh, that person, pardon me, that person kind of took the easy route. It's then like, well, if I'm struggling with that, then, but then I suppose, is it? Sorry, I'm kind of, as I'm talking, I'm thinking about it. Like, if you, from my perspective, if you then, you know, if we're going to say that you take, you know, it's the easy route, then talking about it is actually the more difficult route, and therefore, as a, you know, if we're thinking about stereotypical man, the more admirable route.
And that's, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, that when you actually start to investigate these narratives, they're not straightforward at all. You know, they're so wrapped up in different values and ideals that they almost cancel each other out. And, you know, this is something in therapy that works very well. You know, when you start to really investigate the beliefs that someone holds and the messages and their values, you can help them realize how many faulty and distorted and contradicting beliefs we have, because we're constantly being bombarded by differing values and ideals. And, you know, it's no wonder we're all sort of stressed, and why depression and anxiety is so rife, because our brains haven't evolved to cope with a modern world that has so many different ideas and values that it's feeding us. And so I think this is where therapy plays such a good place in being able to help people unpick that, because once you've identified your values,
mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
And once you've got that meaning and purpose, it's much easier to then build on that and develop the skills to withstand a lot of the things that perpetuate and make eating disorders certainly worse.
Yeah. And I imagine as well, once you've got your values in place, if you then do have internalized biases against, you know, speaking openly about your mental health or whatever, you can then kind of backtrack them and question them against your value of like, okay, so that thing that I've internalized is actually aligned with my value of, you know, whatever is important to me, or is it actually quite counteractive and counterintuitive?
Yeah, and that can be quite transformational when you start to investigate those things. And I mean, eating disorder recovery is transformational anyway. It's oh, I'm going to show what a really big geek I am here. I always compare it to Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. You know, in order to defeat his demon, the Balrog, he has to essentially be reborn. He has to sacrifice a part of himself, but he comes back better. He is still Gandalf, but he is a different version of Gandalf, wiser, more powerful. And that is absolutely what happens in eating disorder recovery. And I could never have imagined myself recovering. I remember never being able to imagine what recovery would look like, because I'd been enmeshed in the eating disorder for so long. And so for anyone listening to this who is in the same boat, I would want to say that, you know, you can't imagine that from where you are, because you will change as you go through recovery.
Mm.
You know, the eating disorder has so much control over the way you think and perceive the world. When that voice calms down, and when that's no longer such a significant part of you, your whole world changes. I never thought I'd be able to have my own private practice. That was so far away from me. But I will say this. When I was 25, I went to see a counsellor, and God bless her, she obviously didn't have any experience with eating disorders, because one of the first things she said to me was, you know, you're going to have to accept you could be battling with this your whole life. And I remember in that moment thinking, if I'm still battling with this in 5 years, I'd rather be dead. And I walked out of that room and never went back. And I was still battling with this for many years after that, not just 5 years. And I was so wrong to think that there wouldn't still be a life to be lived beyond that. You know, I couldn't have imagined being able to do what I'm doing now, having this conversation without my inner critic telling me I'm going to sound like a knob or anything like that. You know, you don't realize the sort of inner resources you've got until you begin to go through that process. And it's just an amazing discovery, and I'm still learning new things about myself.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it, is that it's never going to be over. Like, I think people always say, like, oh, can you be fully recovered from an eating disorder? And I'm like, well, I think it all depends on what you think fully recovered means.
Yes.
Because for me, you know, I hope that I get to a point where I feel that I am, you know, recovered and able to live a life free from an eating disorder. But in terms of, and I think they're probably separate things, like in terms of personal growth and sort of like the things that you learn along the way, you're constantly going to be learning. And, you know, you might get 10 years down the line and have not had an eating disorder thought, and then all of a sudden be somewhere and have an eating disorder thought. And I think it's those moments then that, one, you realize how far you've come,
mm-hmm.
but also then you use those coping mechanisms that you've worked so hard in therapy, or, you know, the ones that you've really got in a robust position now. And it means that you don't then relapse. And that, to me, is what recovery means, is not leaning into the eating disorder behaviours when things get difficult or challenging. And for me personally, you know, I have had an eating disorder since I was 14, and it's been ebbs and flows. And unfortunately, I've had like my biggest relapse over the past year. But I wouldn't say that obviously I would have preferred to not have it, but I was very much living this like partially recovered life, but there were still a lot of things tied up into my life with my eating disorder, but I just accepted that they were normal. And then because of this relapse, because we've had to kind of unpick everything, it's now like, no, we're not leaving any stones unturned, and we're going to do it all so that this doesn't happen in the future. But like, I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't have had the relapse. So I think, you know, you're constantly going through and learning things. And I really hope that in, you know, years to come, this will have all been a journey for us in terms of, you know, learning how to support men in talking about their mental health and to feel that they, you know, are in an environment that they can do that. And we'll probably look back and think, well, God, why didn't we do it like that before? But I think we've very quickly moved into sort of an area, and again, it's completely the right thing, but like where, you know, men and women's opinions are completely equal. And if you think about 10, 20 years ago, that didn't exist. So things move very quickly, and maybe something as sensitive as talking about your mental health, it can't move as quickly because people need to make those gradual adjustments to feel like they can.
I completely agree. And I think this is where, you know, for all of the flaws of things like social media, that there is a place for it to be a force for good. And certainly with the sort of advent of podcasts now, like and subscribe to the Full of Beans podcast. But, you know, this is the, but genuinely, it's this kind of thing that is contributing to that shift that we need to see. You deciding to have a man on your podcast to talk about his experience, those are the little steps we need to take to break down those stigmas. You know, we can certainly hope there'd be governmental interventions and policies that are going to help, but it's that individual level, you know, just having these honest conversations and normalizing these experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that's the thing, isn't it? It needs to change on like a societal level, and people like all need to realize, you know, no matter what their background or whatever, that it, you know, they can speak about their mental health and that's okay. And I think sometimes if we just focus on like the government or like the treatment area, it means that the people within that kind of discipline know it, but we don't know it on like a, you know, societal level. And I think maybe the people that aren't involved day to day in mental health are the ones that we really need to kind of get in contact with, because, you know, somebody like that works in mental health is probably gonna realize, you know, yeah, I could talk about my mental health, and like, you know, mental health affects everybody. But I would say, you know, somebody that doesn't and their job is very distant from that, they may not be able to have those conversations because it's not something that comes naturally to them, or they've not kind of had the awareness that it is okay to talk about things like that.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that is why there's a place for, and a lot of companies are doing this, you know, your sort of corporate focus on various mental health topics and aligning themselves with various campaigns. I think that is part of how we do this, how we open up the conversation. And, you know, most big companies especially have employee assistance programs. And I think really focusing on those programs in line with various campaigns is, again, part of the little steps we need to see, so that it's becoming ingrained at every level of society. You know, it's not just a top-down approach. It is a bottom-up. And, you know, I mentioned I'm an oversharer, and I've caught myself so many times in the past resisting posting something on social media, just like my private social media, about my own experiences, or, you know, in a workplace. But I thought I would rather normalize this for someone else and deal with the inner criticism I would have for thinking, oh, why did I say that? Then this remains something that's taboo and stigmatized, or at least just not acknowledged, because,
yeah,
you know, the reality is people are suffering miserably from eating disorders. People are dying, people are killing themselves, and we're a long way away from getting to the point where that is we're a long way away from seeing that as something which is a rare occurrence.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that like what you said there about like putting your experience out there and worrying that you're oversharing, that has been something that I have battled with like the whole time of doing Full of Beans, because I am also an oversharer. Like, I wear my heart on my sleeve, you know exactly how I'm feeling, but that's just the person that I am, and I don't want to change that, because I think I have like come to the fact of like, I'm proud of the vulnerable person that I can be, and I'm proud. I think that's brave to put yourself out there, and I know that not everyone can do that, but that's totally okay. But I think so many times I've had people say to me, like, you know, I heard you share your story and it made me realize that it was like okay for me to be struggling as well. Oh, not okay for me to be struggling, but like, you know, my struggles were okay to share and I didn't need to be ashamed of it and things like that. And I think, like you said, that's where social media comes in such a good way, in terms of men just sharing their experiences of mental health struggles, or, you know, whatever's going on for them, to you know, you hope that, I really hope from this podcast, if one man listens to this podcast, and then goes away and, you know, speaks to his partner or something and says, you know, I've been struggling a bit with this. I'm not really sure what's going on, but I just want to share it with you, then that would absolutely, like, that's exactly what we're aiming for, in terms of we just want people to know that it is okay to talk. And I think, you know, I'm really grateful that you've come on the podcast today with me to share your experience, because I really think that people will listen and they'll think, you know, Craig shared his story and no one judged him, so nobody's gonna judge me either. I just wanted to end on, I mean, you've given loads of absolutely fantastic advice, but if you had to kind of put it into like a TLDR for the listeners, what would you say if somebody is struggling, what would be your first port of advice to somebody?
My first port of advice, I think, certainly open up to someone you trust. I think that is the first step. Open up to someone you trust, who you can at least just say, look, I'm having these struggles. I don't know what it means. I don't know what to do about it. But I think that's got to be the first step. And that's often the hardest step. You know, it's once you acknowledge that you're struggling, not just to yourself, but to someone else. You've taken the most difficult step, and that can be what then propels you forward. So support networks are so important. So identify that trusted person in your life and have that conversation.
Definitely. I think, what was I just going to say? I think, like, saying the words out loud, that you can kind of have the thought in your head and maybe acknowledge to yourself that there's something, but saying it out loud can feel so daunting. But whilst, you know, if it's that level of daunting, imagine the level of freedom you're going to get from saying that out loud and somebody else knowing. It's like a massive weight off your shoulders. You're not carrying it alone anymore. So I think that's really great advice. And I think as well, something I always like to say is, we always talk about like support networks and stuff being family or friends or whatever. There is like no person that's off limits in terms of who you want to speak to in order to get support. If it's the person that you trust and want to share that information with, like, you know, it could be the bin man. If you've got a good relationship with your bin man or your postman or whatever, then I think it's just finding somebody that can be that support to you, that you feel comfortable. Because I think sometimes, you know, there might be people in your family that people would recommend that you go and speak to, but you might not feel comfortable.
Yes.
But I think that is, I would agree that that's definitely the first thing to do, is to speak to somebody. And I always like to think of it as, you know, at the moment, it's you versus the eating disorder. But when you tell somebody about what's going on, you bring somebody else on to your side, and then, you know, two versus one, you know who's going to win. And also, I just wanted to say as well, it really made me laugh about your Lord of the Rings reference, because was it Lord of the Rings? It was Lord of the Rings.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I've never watched. But mine was a very similar thing. When I was going through my eating for the first time, I created this like world in my head where I was Harry Potter and the eating disorder was Voldemort. And they say on that, don't they, like, neither can live whilst the other survives. Which is very true, because you can't survive. You can survive, but you're not living when you've got an eating disorder. So, you know, Foldy needs to get in the bin.
I'm going to have to develop some metaphors around that, like how we do an Expelliarmus to disarm the eating disorder first, yes, before we Avada Kedavra.
Yeah, honestly, when they talk about perfectionism and anorexia, I was pretty on it with this. I literally had a book, and I had listed in it like every single character and which character they were in my life. which spell meant which thing, which did detract from recovering from the eating disorder. So if you do that, I would recommend that you just, you know, go lightly with the references rather than, you know, focusing on developing this Harry Potter world and not your recovery. So
good
that
advice.
Would be my advice. But Craig, it's been absolutely lovely to chat to you. Thank you so much for sharing your story and all the advice that you brought. Where can people go to find out more about you and to get in touch?
Thank you. You're doing amazing work and I really appreciate you giving me the time to come on and speak today. You can find me on Instagram and TikTok at Craig Lee Therapy or my website www.craigleetherapy.co.uk.
Amazing. Brilliant. And I'll put them in the show notes as well so people have got access to them. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have an amazing time in Glasgow. Although I feel like it'd be very cold up there. But you're basically there, aren't you, really, in Durham?
Well, a couple of hours, but yeah. I won't criticise your geography, but...
You're a lot closer than I am, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah. Thank you so much. It's been really lovely to chat to you. And I'll let you go enjoy your Sunday afternoon.
Oh, thanks. You too, Han. Take care of yourself.
Cool. Okay. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.